This is Guns and Butter.
All the rhetoric of pro-democracy. I call it the weaponization of democracy and human rights. And this has become, in the last 30 years since NED was created, something called the National Endowment for Democracy. It's become a huge industry and a very refined, very polished, and very effective regime change apparatus.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, F. William Engdahl. Today's show, Fake Democracy, How Washington Destroyed Poland and Russia in the 1990s. William Engdahl is an international political analyst and author. He is currently visiting professor of geopolitics at Northwest University, Xi'an, China. Among his best-known books are A Century of War, Anglo-American Oil Politics and the New World Order, Gods of Money, Wall Street and the Death of the American Century, and Seeds of Destruction, The Hidden Agenda of Genetic Manipulation, completing a trilogy on the control of oil, food, and money. He is also author of The Lost Hegemon, Whom the Gods Would Destroy, about the CIA and political Islam. Today we discuss his new book, Manifest Destiny, Democracy as Cognitive Dissonance. William Engdahl, welcome back to Guns and Butter.
Bonnie, I'm delighted to be back with you.
You write in your introduction to your new book, Manifest Destiny, Democracy as Cognitive Dissonance, that at the end of the Cold War and the dissolution of the old USSR, that Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Colin Powell told Army Times in April 1991, quote, "Think hard about it. I'm running out of demons. I'm running out of villains. I'm down to Castro and Kim Il-sung," end quote. You write that the dilemma was soon to be resolved. Washington unveiled a dramatic new weapon, fake democracy, non-governmental organizations, NGOs, that would be used to covertly create pro-Washington regimes in strategic parts of the world. According to your book, it all started early in 1983 when Reagan's CIA director, William Casey, convinced Reagan to create a kind of shadow CIA, a private non-governmental organization that would escape the scrutiny and criticism of the CIA. That NGO was the National Endowment for Democracy. What was the stated purpose of the National Endowment for Democracy, and what was its real purpose?
First of all, the name National Endowment for Democracy was chosen deliberately for its resonance with other government agencies, such as the National Endowment for Humanities or National Endowment for Arts. So this word endowment makes it sound very noble, philanthropic. But the aim of it, Alan Weinstein, who wrote the legislation to create NED back in the 80s under Reagan, gave an interview to the Washington Post years later. He said, a lot of what we do today was done covertly years ago by the CIA. And that really says it all right there. You have to go into the context of the early 1980s. You had congressional committees, you had the Church Committee, you had Gerald Ford, this was a little bit earlier, in the 70s, you had Gerald Ford appointing a committee with Nelson Rockefeller in charge to examine all these accusations that the CIA was running rogue operations, was running assassination and regime change around the world from Iran to Guatemala and Chile with Pinochet dictatorship and so forth. And Casey was looking, as Reagan's CIA chief in the early 80s, Casey was looking for a way to take the spotlight, the heat off of the agency. And he and several people around him came up with the idea of privatizing the CIA destabilization dirty tricks functions. And that became the National Endowment for Democracy.
Well, what did they say that the purpose of the National Endowment for Democracy was?
The stated purpose in the legislation would be to promote democracy, promote human rights against totalitarian governments around the world that are anti-democratic. And they would do it with taxpayer dollars. So this is the part about it that isn't so widely discussed, but the big money for the NED, let's call it, comes from the U.S. Congress. It's a government-funded operation, and it works in collaboration with something called the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, connected with the State Department, but de facto connected with the CIA. It's used all around the world as a conduit for CIA dirty tricks and arms smuggling and so forth. So the National Endowment for Democracy was, I call it a brilliant tactic of the U.S. government to create dirty tricks against people that it's not fond of. And one of the neocons, Joshua Muravchik of Freedom House, the CIA front, said the idea of the NED was to create, quote, a second layer of insulation between recipients of U.S. government money and the U.S. government, and that funds originating in the Treasury, distributed by an independent private agency, would not be tied to any particular U.S. administration, and these are more acceptable. So if China finds that something called the National Endowment for Democracy is trying to create a, you know, revolution in China against the Communist Party, it doesn't sound as sinister as saying that the CIA has been caught with their hands in the cookie jar. So that's more or less the way it has been constructed. And it's all the rhetoric of pro-democracy. I call it the weaponization of democracy and human rights. And this has become, in the last 30 years since NED was created, it's become a huge industry and a very refined, very polished, and very effective regime change apparatus.
What is the National Democratic Institute, the NDI, and what are the other National Endowment for Democracy affiliates? Because the NED is not the only one, right?
Right. There are essentially four of these. And the National Democratic Institute is loosely affiliated with the Democratic Party. Keep in mind, the Democratic Party, the Republican Party, the two main parties in the United States today, are not entirely clean organizations, as is not the AFL-CIO. And all three of those are connected through these subsidiaries of NED. For example, when you have a democratic or social democratic government in some part of the world, let's say South America or whatever, and they have fraternal relations with the U.S. Democratic Party, then the National Democratic Institute would be the vehicle that would be used to influence that government. And the head of the National Democratic Institute today is Madeleine Albright, the former Secretary of State during the Yugoslav War. So, and then the other daughter institutes are the International Republican Institute, which has a more right-wing profile. It's tied to the Republican Party, but independent. And it's funded also by USAID, which is, as I said earlier, a conduit often for the CIA's dirty tricks. And it's headed by Senator John McCain, at least up until his recent illness, the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee. So John McCain was instrumental in the coup d'etat in Ukraine, for example, in 2014, as head of the IRI, International Republican Institute, of the National Endowment. And the other one is called the Solidarity Center, which is tied to the AFL-CIO Labor Federation. Going back to Walter Reuther and the Cold War days in the 1950s, the AFL-CIO has always had a fairly tight relation, internationally at least, with the U.S. State Department and intelligence community. And then finally, there's something called the Center for International Private Enterprise, which is tied to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. So those four are the four arms of the National Endowment for Democracy, and they disperse grant money in all sorts of very sly and subtle ways to create regime change around the world.
Wow, that's very interesting. And all these four offshoots of the National Endowment for Democracy, they're all funded through the government, correct?
That's correct, yes.
At the very same time as the creation of the National Endowment for Democracy, the Soros Foundation was founded in 1984 in Budapest, Hungary, by currency speculator George Soros, who had been born there. Do you think that these two NGOs, the National Endowment for Democracy and the Soros Foundation, which were founded at the same time, were working together from the very start?
I would be shocked if somebody could prove to me that they were not working together from the very start. Every place where the U.S. State Department wants to make regime change, whether it be Ukraine, whether it be Poland back in the end of the 80s, early 90s with its shock therapy and so forth, whether it be Myanmar or whatever, the Soros Foundation is inevitably there right by side of the National Endowment for Democracy and Freedom House and a few others. So it's a battery, if you will, a battery of NGOs, fake democracy NGOs, I call them, that are deployed so that it appears from every single different direction that there's this huge popular movement for change in different countries. And the change is always geared toward the benefit of the U.S. State Department's agenda at any particular time.
Now, according to your book, George Soros recruited Jeffrey Sachs from Harvard University to work with him in the Soros Foundation. Was Jeffrey Sachs recruited by Soros early on in the founding of the Soros Foundation?
Well, it's at the very latest by the end of the 1980s when the Reagan administration was, and then the later George Bush Sr., were involved in toppling the communist government in Poland using Solidarność, the Lech Walesa's trade union umbrella organization. And so the Soros and Jeffrey Sachs were working very, very closely, first in Poland, where shock therapy was applied in the first case through Jeffrey Sachs called it shock therapy. And the idea of that was you have state enterprises that have existed for some 45 years in Poland and Czech Republic or Czechoslovakia then and Hungary and other countries. So the only way to get rid of the habits of communism, argued Jeffrey Sachs, was to have an economic shock to free the prices up immediately, to, you know, let them go to world market prices. But the wages in those countries were not freed up. So you had a huge unemployment. You had bankrupting of state-owned enterprises. And then people like George Soros would move in for the kill and using dollars, because the currencies were collapsing in these countries, using American dollars, they were able to buy up the crown jewels of Poland and other countries for pennies. So that's the shock therapy model. And Soros and Sachs worked very closely, not only in Poland, but later in the former Soviet Union.
I'm speaking with scholar and author William Engdahl. Today's show, Fake Democracy: How Washington Destroyed Poland and Russia in the 1990s. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. You write that the first target of the CIA's new democracy NGO, the National Endowment for Democracy, was to infiltrate and subvert the Warsaw Pact and the Soviet Union itself. Since Poland was considered the weak link in the Warsaw Pact, the attack began there. Why was Poland considered the weak link in Moscow's chain of control?
The key to the Poland transformation or destabilization of the Communist Party was the election of Pope John Paul II and the diplomacy of Ronald Reagan and the Reagan administration with Pope John Paul II. He had a meeting in 1982 when Ronald Reagan first became president. Reagan went to the Vatican and privately met the Pope, the new Polish Pope. And they agreed to a clandestine campaign to simply bring down the communist Warsaw Pact alliance. And it was described by Richard Allen, the national security advisor at the time to Reagan, as one of the great secret alliances of all time, because Moscow was never able politically to significantly weaken the influence of the Catholic Church in Poland. They had to tolerate it. And there's a quite, if it's accurate or not, we'll never know, but quite a telling comment from Edward Gierek, the head of the Polish Communist government then, in a cabinet session where it was announced that Wojtyla, the Polish foreign cardinal, had just been elected Pope in 1978. And Gierek reportedly said, "Oh God, what are we going to do now? Jesus and Mary, this is the end." This is from a communist leader. So I can imagine that something like that was the case, because then the National Endowment for Democracy, in coordination with a network of priests in Poland that the Vatican recruited to this, were able to smuggle in fax machines and, you know, all sorts of equipment to Solidarność in order to begin getting out propaganda against the communist government. The Free Trade Union Institute of the NED played a crucial role in that. And they put tens of millions of U.S. dollars into that destabilization.
So would you say then that for the Vatican to name a Polish Pope, that was a strategic move politically from the very start? I mean, that's why John Paul II was chosen, wouldn't you think?
Well, this gets into a controversy over the College of Cardinals. There are different accounts from Catholic scholars who say that Washington exerted strong influence on the College of Cardinals to get John Paul II elected. I'm not in a position to prove that one way or the other. But what is clear is that once a Polish pope was in the Vatican as pope, the Reagan administration began to work with him to bring down the communist regime and open the door for the church to come back in.
Right. And I think it's very significant that the role of George H.W. Bush in all of this, he began as Reagan's vice president, of course, and then went on to become president from 89 to 93. And that's when all of these destabilizations really got rolling.
Yeah.
With regard to the Polish Pope, John Paul II, then Ronald Reagan, with George H.W. Bush, etc., they're all working with the CIA, right?
Yeah, oh yeah. Well, George H.W. Bush had been the director of the CIA back in the 70s, and he always maintained a close network of CIA old boys that he worked with inside the agency as well as outside, supposedly private.
Yes, I was surprised to read in your new book, Manifest Destiny, that actually it was President Carter who had, fired 300 CIA agents that had worked under George H.W. Bush as CIA director. Is that right?
Yes, yes. And then Bush kind of regrouped these ex-CIA pals of his, or whatever you want to call them, into private entities that continued as kind of a rogue CIA.
What role did Solidarnosc, the Polish trade union, play in the looting and asset stripping of Poland? And was this Polish trade union different from other trade unions in Poland?
The Solidarnosc, you remember the Polish dock workers, ship workers in the north of Poland, where Lech Walesa, the trade union leader of Solidarnosc, was based, and he eventually got a Nobel Peace Prize, like Barack Obama, for loyal service to the U.S. government, I guess. But he and Solidarnosc led mass demonstrations in Poland, which conveniently hid the role of the church. And those demonstrations effectively were so big that they brought down the Communist Party. And in 1990, the Communist Jaruzelski resigned as Polish leader, and Walesa, the head of Solidarnosc, was elected president. And that, in answer to your question, that is the point at which Jeffrey Sachs of Harvard University and the shock therapy and George Soros were given essentially a free rein to strip the Polish economy of anything of value. And they did a pretty good job. They went together with an IMF program, International Monetary Fund, in 1990. And the Soros had a foundation called the Stefan Batory Foundation in Warsaw. And they simply destroyed the old Polish economy. The government was not allowed to create national bank money to finance budget deficits. So you had no choice but, according to the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, to have savage austerity, cut the government expenses. That led to hundreds of thousands of Polish government employees out of work. And then price controls, government price controls were ended. Apartment rents, costs for fuel, for transportation, and heating were suddenly at Western market levels instead of these subsidized Eastern Soviet levels. And then French, Italian, German products were allowed to be imported free of tariff. And this Soros Sachs shock therapy was called the Balcerowicz plan, to give it a Polish kind of fig leaf. The finance minister was Leszek Balcerowicz at the time. The result of the shock therapy is inflation rose almost 600% in the first year. And the currency, the zloty, was in a free float against the dollar and dropped like a stone. So this is what was done to Poland. And then once you pushed the economy and the wage levels down to the bottom, you could open up the economy for sale to Western buyers like German industry or French or whatever. And that's essentially the history of Poland at the time.
Now, how did they kick off the economic shock therapy in Poland? Was Poland in debt to the IMF? Was that how this started?
Well, it was in debt during the 80s. Poland began borrowing, or in the 70s actually, Poland, like Yugoslavia, began borrowing from very willing to lend Western banks like Chase Manhattan or Citigroup or JP Morgan and so forth. And at that time they were separate. The dollar debts of Poland were, at the time of the early 80s and the destabilization, they were simply out of proportion. They were unpayable. So that was the basis on which the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, was brought in, say, okay, you want Western credits. This was the trade-off that was promised under Harvard shock therapy. You want Western bank credits to finance your economy and invest in your economy. You have to follow the dictates of the International Monetary Fund from Washington. And those dictates were to simply like an asset stripping of the Polish economy.
What surprises me about all of this with regard to Poland and other countries is that under communist rule, why would they be borrowing money from Western banks?
They were borrowing because they had to have hard currencies to invest in the economy. And the stresses of the Soviet Union in the 80s to keep up with the military buildup of the Reagan administration, the debacle in Afghanistan, Nicaragua, and various other things where the West was putting simultaneous pressure on Moscow. Moscow was increasing the pressure on the Comecon, the Eastern European economies, to finance its military budget to keep up with the U.S. So to keep its population content as much as possible, they began borrowing from the West, from Western banks. And at the beginning of the borrowing, the interest rates were very low. And then into the 1980s, there came this Paul Volcker shock therapy in the early 80s, and the interest rates went soaring. And that's when they had to borrow more money to roll over the, you know, the old debt and whatnot. They got into a debt trap. And that was, I think, very deliberately done by the West.
Oh, I see. So it was the United States' pressure on the Soviet Union with the arms race, etc., that that began to bankrupt the USSR, and then that had a domino effect in the Warsaw Pact that Moscow couldn't be as big of a help to these countries, perhaps, as it had been in the past.
Yeah, more or less that.
Yeah, that makes sense.
That energy subsidies, they got their energy from Russian, you know, gas fields, Siberian gas fields and so forth. So the Russian government, or the Soviet government then, had to increase the cost of natural gas to the Polish economy, things like that. So then that has a knock-on effect throughout the whole economy.
Now, you also mentioned that the Polish government was not able to issue its own credit, meaning that somehow the U.S. and the Soros Foundation, et cetera, was able to dollarize the Polish economy. Is that right?
Exactly what they did, and they did the same thing later with Russian Federation after the collapse of the Soviet Union. But that was dictated by the International Monetary Fund. So they had a debt crisis. The Western creditors were demanding their pound of flesh. The government of Lech Walesa said, well, what do we do? And they said, you have to free float the zloty, the Polish currency, against the dollar and create market conditions. And your central bank can't print money to, you know, to paper over the crisis. So it's created catastrophe. And, you know, it was a completely predictable catastrophe for the real economy.
Yeah, well, dollarizing the economies of countries through the IMF, I mean, this is what's done constantly, right? It just happened in Brazil a couple of years ago. Same thing,
sure.
Right?
Sure. It's always the same recipe by the IMF. They force these governments to free float their currency, devalue it, you know, drastically against the dollar. And then the only currency of real value seemed to be the dollar. So it has that effect.
I'm speaking with scholar and author William Engdahl. Today's show, Fake Democracy, How Washington Destroyed Poland and Russia in the 1990s. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. You write that the 1986 oil price collapse that was engineered by the U.S. State Department and Saudi Arabia hurt Russia tremendously. Was that its intent? Was this 1986 oil price collapse, was that all orchestrated in order to hurt Russia?
I think it was, and I've written about this in several of my books, Myths, Lies, and Oil Wars, among them Century of War. And I've looked at the State Department documents when George Shultz was Secretary of State and George Bush Sr. was Vice President, but very active, hands-on, de facto foreign policy president under Reagan. And they worked with the Saudis. The Saudis wanted to regain domination of the oil pricing within OPEC, and the U.S. wanted to do a number of things. One, Bush wanted to become president in 1988, and a dramatic collapse of the oil price would give the economy a nice shot in the arm so that people would have a feel-good effect, and good economy means Republicans are easy to reelect, or George Bush Sr. But I think the effect on bringing down the Soviet Union was the centerpiece of that 1986 oil price collapse. And what it did, it was done at the same time that the Reagan CIA and the National Endowment for Democracy were promoting the Solidarność in Poland. They were doing the Afghan Mujahideen operations against the Soviet Red Army in Afghanistan and against the pro-Moscow government in Nicaragua. So on every corner, Moscow was under huge pressure. Plus, Reagan had announced in 1983 what the press called Star Wars, this ballistic missile defense program that really, and I know from Russian think tanks shortly after the collapse of the Soviet Union, told me that that really was the straw that broke the camel's back to try to keep up military spending with the U.S. missile defense initiative. So all of this put huge strains on Russia, and Bush played the key role in that.
What were executive orders 12333 and then executive order 13233, which was Bush Jr., George W. Bush?
Essentially what those executive orders did was, it's a well-known secret in Washington that Ronald Reagan was not a hands-on president, especially in foreign policy, and he signed an order, an executive order, 12333, a national security directive, actually was drafted by Bush's people, Bush's vice president, that effectively, secretly put George Herbert Walker Bush in charge of all Reagan U.S. foreign and national security operations after 1981. And when George W. Bush became president in 2001, one of the first things he did was to sign another executive order, which claimed as national security the grounds to conceal records of past president, especially his father during the collapse of the Soviet Union. So those two taken together have kept most of the nefarious activities of the Bush family and the CIA and the U.S. State Department in the destruction of Russia in the 1990s from the public eye.
What was George H.W. Bush's network, the Enterprise? How was it formed and what did it do?
If you remember back in the later part of the Reagan administration in the 1980s, you had Colonel Oliver North and other intelligence officials around the Bush networks that were involved in something that became called the Iran-Contra affair. And the Iran-Contra were the Nicaraguan Contras. They were anti-communist. They were supported by the CIA and the U.S. government. They were also involved in heavy drug running into an airfield in Arkansas called Mena, Arkansas, when William Jefferson Clinton was governor. So we'll leave that aside for now. But the Iran-Contra operation was ultimately run by something that was known in their correspondence, in their kind of covert deep state that called itself the Enterprise. And they worked directly for Vice President Bush. And what they were engaged in was violating the laws of Congress, essentially, to sell weapons to Iran and also to the Contras in Nicaragua, where Congress didn't want to get involved. So that almost brought down George Bush, except for the fact that he was able to sweep it under the rug and get Reagan to pardon him from any prosecution. So the enterprise, so this was General Richard Secord, Colonel Oliver North, and a whole network of handpicked CIA old boys. They were kept together, the machinery was kept together to begin to go into the Soviet Union in the late 1980s, well before the collapse, and began cultivating corrupt KGB generals. And this was the real origins of the Russian oligarchs, not so-called Russian organized crime, as the Western media called it, but it was a CIA, a George Bush operation to recruit KGB generals that were corruptible, that would do anything for becoming a billionaire in the collapse of their own Soviet state.
Well, that's very interesting. Then George H.W. Bush's the Enterprise Network were the ones that initially corrupted these KGB officers, which then ultimately, of course, led to a very complex, decades-long looting and stripping of Russia. Is that right?
I call it in my book, in the Manifest Destiny book, I call it the rape of Russia. And that's, there's no other term that describes what was done by these this operation of George Bush Sr. and the CIA old boys around him and the bankers that he worked with. They put Boris Yeltsin in as their handpicked man to loot the Russian treasury of its gold reserves, for example. The Yeltsin family was a mafia, included the so-called oligarchs that emerged with the privatization of all these state assets, the world's largest aluminum company, some of the world's largest and most high-tech military companies. You had privatization of mostly raw materials, and just huge fortunes were being made by these oligarchs and their bankers in the West.
What was George H.W. Bush's Operation Hammer? Was it a four-part plan, and what was it?
Bush, you know, the CIA likes these acronyms. Operation Hammer was the destruction and attack on the post-communist Russian Federation, the destruction of the Soviet Union. So the West brought down the Soviet Union in a very, very determined way. If you want to understand the real roots of the animosity, the venom between Washington, between the State Department, the CIA, U.S. intelligence, British intelligence, and Russia under Putin, you have to really understand what I detail in this, in the book, and in terms of the rape of Russia and the role of the U.S. in the early 90s under Yeltsin. So Operation Hammer called for the CIA to secretly finance the famous general's coup against Gorbachev back in August 91. That was the coup that brought Boris Yeltsin on top of the tank outside the White House in near Red Square in Moscow. And Western media very quickly pushed Yeltsin as the great democratic hero against the corrupt and dictatorial Gorbachev. And then the next part of the Operation Hammer, they'd use a secret financial resources, a war chest, to destabilize the currency, the ruble, you know, to collapse it. And then they corrupted officials of the National Bank, it was called Gosbank under the Soviet times, to steal the Russian Federation official gold reserves. And the final phase was the privatization of strategic energy, raw materials, high-tech military industry in the Soviet Union. And that was done with the IMF dictated privatization. It was done again with Harvard's Jeffrey Sachs and other Harvard economists working in Moscow, and Yeltsin's finance minister, Yegor Gaidar, and George Soros, of course.
You write about Riggs Bank of Washington, D.C., and Republic Bank of New York, about Riggs Volmet S.A. How were George H.W. and Jonathan Bush connected to these banks, and what was the purpose of these banks?
The money that these oligarchs were making, as long as it stayed in Russia, was very vulnerable. If Yeltsin would ever be toppled, and God forbid someone like Vladimir Putin, a nationalist, would become president, then those assets could be seized. So they needed, these oligarchs needed to get their money out of Russia. And there, the Bush networks, the CIA old boys and so forth, came willingly to the service of these new Russian oligarchs, these new billionaires. So one of the key banks, it's now changed name and so forth, was a bank in Washington, D.C. called Riggs Bank. And since the 1960s, Riggs Bank had been known as a CIA bank during the Cuba Bay of Pigs operation. And the Riggs Bank had created an international banking group called Riggs Falmet, you mentioned. And the brother of George Herbert Walker Bush, now President Bush, Jonathan Bush, worked with Riggs Bank to set up Riggs Valmet in Geneva to launder the money of these Russian oligarchs. So you really have an incestuous operation where the Russian oligarchs are completely dependent on these Western banks that are connected with the CIA. So, any time the U.S. government would want to, they could pull the plug on these oligarchs if they stopped, doing what they were told to do.
I'm speaking with scholar and author William Engdahl. Today's show, Fake Democracy, How Washington Destroyed Poland and Russia in the 1990s. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. And I think you write that Antigua became the destination for much of the looted Russian assets. And I suppose that worked the same way?
Yeah. Antigua, the Isle of Man, which is an offshore money laundering center that the British control. Shell companies were set up so you could never trace this. And it's interesting to note, Bonnie, that the names of these oligarchs, they were young meaning in their 30s and 40s, proteges of these old KGB generals that worked with the Bush enterprise, Operation Hammer. And among them were Mikhail Khodorkovsky, the one who later became famous as the head of Yukos Oil and later became put in prison for corruption and fraud and tax avoidance by the Putin presidency. But Roman Abramovich, who went on to buy a football club in the UK and left Russia, and Boris Berezovsky, who was one of the nastiest of these young oligarchs, and they were known as the kids of the corrupt KGB generals. They were trained by these Western bankers like Jonathan Bush and others to launder money. They were trained in money laundering. So the levels of corruption and financial incest involved in the rape of Russia by the West, by the CIA, by George Bush's networks, and then as soon as he became president, the Bill Clinton with Larry Summers as Deputy Treasury Secretary running these Harvard economists out of Moscow.
What can you tell us about the Russian bank Menatep? I believe in your book you say that Khodorkovsky actually had acquired 100 state enterprises before he ever even got a hold of Yukos Oil.
Yeah. Well, he was on the inside. These young prospective oligarchs were working with the Yeltsin finance ministry, with the Harvard economists, with George Soros there was a coupon privatization that the idea was 140 million coupons would be distributed, one to every man, woman, and child in the Russian Federation. And those coupons were good for a share of these soon-to-be-privatized state companies. Well, if you have only one coupon and you don't even know where you're going to get enough money to buy food, there was a black market in buying and selling these coupons on the street corners back then for hard currency dollars. So Berezovsky, Khodorkovsky, and these prospective oligarchs began buying up, like a vacuum cleaner, buying up all these coupons. And then in these corrupt privatization auctions, they were able to essentially steal state assets for pennies on the dollar. And I think someone estimated that the entirety of the Russian Federation economy through these vouchers was valued at something like $54 billion. This was a multi-trillion dollar economy of oil resources, some of the biggest oil companies in the world, of the aluminum, of gold mines and whatnot. And through the coupon rigging and the fraud around that, these oligarchs and their Western banker friends around George Bush Sr. and later around the Clinton administration were able to simply steal the state assets of the Russian people. That's the best way to understand it. It was about the value of the General Electric Company on the New York Stock Exchange for the entire Russian economy. That's what these vouchers or coupons, if you translated, would price the assets.
It's hard to even comprehend such a ripoff.
Yeah. It's just astonishing. And the forbearance of the Russian people. I've been to Russia many times as a researcher and doing interviews and whatnot over the last, since 1994. And the forbearance of the Russian people not to become bitterly anti-American after what was done to them is quite remarkable.
Could you talk a little bit about the Harvard Institute for International Development, which received, I believe you written, USAID grants? What was their role in the takedown of the old USSR?
The Harvard HIID, that you just mentioned, Institute for International Development, was a very clever scheme by a former Harvard professor, Larry Summers, who was now in the Bill Clinton Treasury in Washington. And Larry Summers was running the looting of the Russian Federation economy. And he sent Jeffrey Sachs, a former Harvard professor, like Summers, and several other Harvard economists that worked with Summers to Moscow to set up this HIID. And the HIID later was investigated for fraud and corruption, and the Harvard University had to pay millions of dollars in fines because of that. So essentially, Harvard was used to kind of launder the destruction of the Russian economy. I think the argument would be that if you use the State Department, it would be too obvious, like the National Endowment for Democracy. You want to hide behind the skirts of a reputable university like Harvard and then do all the dirty work. So it was, in effect, this network of Larry Summers in the Clinton Treasury Department that was doing this with the USAID monies, which was a CIA front agency for the most part.
And you write about something called Open Russia that involved Jacob Lord Rothschild, George Soros, and Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who you've already said got a hold of Yukos Oil, and even Henry Kissinger. What was Open Russia?
Well, Open Russia, Soros's foundation was called Open Society, and Khodorkovsky was in the process of literally buying the Russian Duma parliament for millions of dollars, just bribing them. to get them to change the laws on ownership of minerals, oil and gas, under the ground, and also the pipeline laws that would favor the state. You know, one thing that Vladimir Putin did when he became president in 1999 or 2000 was to take concrete measures to stabilize the state organizations of oil and gas, energy, and defense, you know, to have something to work with to keep the nation from being completely looted and destroyed, turned into a casino, which is what was done under Yeltsin. So Khodorkovsky created this Open Russia Foundation as kind of his philanthropic front. And on the board of that, as you mentioned, were Lord Rothschild of London, of the famous London banking family, and also Henry Kissinger gave it a nice touch there. But when Khodorkovsky was arrested, he secretly transferred, or tried to transfer, ownership of Yukos Oil to Jacob Rothschild. It didn't work. The Russian courts threw that out, but that was what he was trying to do there.
Actually, how was it that Vladimir Putin was selected somehow to be part of the Boris Yeltsin government? When did that happen?
In 1998, 2 years after the election, the Yeltsin Kremlin was forced into a compromise because the Duma refused to ratify Viktor Chernomyrdin as prime minister. So to calm this opposition, which by then was getting very animated and lively, Yeltsin named a very respected outsider to head the government as prime minister, Yevgeny Primakov, a former head of the KGB foreign intelligence and former foreign minister, as prime minister. And as soon as Primakov became prime minister, he went after one of the top Yeltsin oligarchs, Berezovsky, who fled to London as a result of the arrest warrant for his involvement in an Aeroflot ticket scam. And then Primakov, when he learned that the U.S. government, the Clinton administration, was illegally bombing Serbia in March of 99, he was on a Russian jet en route to meetings in Washington. He immediately ordered the pilot to return to Moscow, and that became called the Primakov Loop. And in Moscow, he protested that Yeltsin had to intervene to support the Serbs, historical allies of Russia. And at that, Yeltsin fired Primakov, using the economy as an excuse. So it was getting very, very uncomfortable for Yeltsin at this point. He'd lost control. When NATO started bombing Serbia illegally, Yeltsin lost control of his own military, and the military ordered Russian troops to seize the airport in Kosovo, Pristina. And this was the beginning of the end of Yeltsin. If you don't have control over the military, you don't have the power of persuasion. So he fired his interim prime minister and looked for an unknown who could be manipulated, he thought, to continue the game. And that unknown was an official from the mayor's office of St. Petersburg named Vladimir Putin. Putin had little political experience and somehow was able to convince Yeltsin and the various oligarchs that Putin would be amenable to the oligarchs and their agenda, that they could do business with Putin. And that seems to have been a KGB deception operation on the part of the group of nationalists around Putin. And once Putin was appointed, he gave Yeltsin an ultimatum to resign or face real consequences for corruption and crimes. So Yeltsin resigned in December 1999 and named Prime Minister Putin as acting president until the March elections the following year. And that is the beginning of the Putin era. And until this day, the CIA and the State Department and every successive U.S. president loathes the figure of Vladimir Putin because he put a block into the complete destruction of Russia as a functioning state. He's a nationalist. That's the best way to understand it.
Now, you mentioned the war in Yugoslavia. Let's cover that next week.
Okay. That's an incredible story, as most of the stories are that I document in this book. When I finished it, I stood back from what I'd researched and put together. And even I was shocked at some of this. But that's how the fake democracy machine of the U.S. government has tried to build its power, build the one world order, new world order, Bush Senior called it.
William Engdahl, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bonnie. It's a pleasure to work with you and to be on with you again. To create a war in the heart of Europe was seen by certain people in Washington around Bush and later Clinton as a very good way to say Europe can't handle it. We have to have NATO. And that's indeed what took place in the 90s.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, F. William Engdahl. Today's show, Fake Democracy, the CIA and their NGOs target China and Yugoslavia in the 1990s. William Engdahl, welcome back.
Well, Bonnie, I'm glad to be back with you and to talk further about my new book, Manifest Destiny, Democracy is Cognitive Dissonance.
According to your book, Manifest Destiny, 1989 was the year George H.W. Bush was sworn in as president, and early in that same year decided to launch a total assault on the flailing communist regimes from Moscow to Beijing to Belgrade. Were the student pro-democracy protests in China in Tiananmen Square in the summer of 1989 spontaneous?
This was part of what you just described. And the striking thing that I realized as I was researching the book is that the Bush administration, the National Endowment for Democracy, the fake democracy NGOs that had been created under Reagan and Bush in the 80s, were deployed simultaneously in 1989 in Russia, or the Soviet Union, and the Warsaw Pact, in China, and in Yugoslavia. And the idea became very clear to me, was to simply bust open the entire part of the world economy that had been off limits or very much under control, looting terms, to the Western multinationals and banks. So they activated these Washington so-called democracy NGOs in all three places simultaneously.
What can you tell us about George H.W. Bush's different involvements with communist China? He went back quite a ways with China, didn't he?
Yeah, well, Bush had been the ambassador to China earlier, before he became vice president and then president. And he had a very special connection to so-called liberal circles in the Chinese Communist Party Central Committee, and was trying to influence them in a certain direction, Zhao Ziyang among them.
Well, how was the U.S. able to influence economic policy in communist China? Who was this Zhao Ziyang?
Well, he had been a governor in Sichuan province and had been responsible for limited agriculture reforms that created a boom in food production, and that came to the attention of Deng Xiaoping, who was the supreme leader at the time. And Zhao was made by Deng to be the architect of the pro-market changes that came after 1979 in China, the opening up to the West, if you will, that had been begun under Nixon and Henry Kissinger. And it seemed like this was bringing a lot of positive economic development for China up until 1979. Now, what's not clear is whether Zhao Ziyang was simply gullible and was influenced by promises from Bush and from people in Washington and so forth, and thought naively that they wanted everything good for China rather than everything good for their U.S. Special interests.
Who was U.S. ambassador to China at the time of Tiananmen?
Well, this is a really crucial figure, and I say in the book, and I document this, that James R. Lilly was the point person orchestrating the Tiananmen Square. You asked if this had been a spontaneous student demonstration. It wasn't. But the entire student protest was orchestrated by Gene Sharp, the founder of the Albert Einstein Institution, who wrote this famous handbook, From Dictatorship to Democracy, and developed nonviolence as a weapon of warfare. And Gene Sharp's handbook has been used in every color revolution or every NGO, you know, pro-democracy destabilization that the CIA has run up until the present. So these people were brought in. George Soros had a foundation for the opening of China, and so he was involved in that. And the National Endowment for Democracy, the International Republican Institute, John McCain's offshoot of the NED. So they were all over the place in China just at the time that the students began calling this protest. The funny thing about the protests is the fact that the demands of the students were anything but revolutionary. This was not something you were doing to when they started these hunger strikes in May. That came, by the way, from the textbook of Gene Sharp and the Albert Einstein crowd. But the student leaders called a hunger strike on Tiananmen Square, and they published a manifesto. And I'll read you the protest demands of the students, saying, "We are doing a hunger strike, risking, you know, starving yourself to death, presumably, to, quote, protest the government's indifference to student demonstrations, to protest the government failure to enter a dialogue with students, to protest the government's unfair characterization of the student democratic movement as turmoil." And their requests were for an immediate equal dialogue between government and student. So this was not a to the death mass protest, but because of the hunger strike and because of the fact that Mikhail Gorbachev of the Soviet Union came in this same time on a state visit, the hunger strike was timed to coincide with that so that all the world media would be in Beijing. And there was a mass phenomena where it grew to something between 3 and 5 million students gathering in Beijing and elsewhere. So this was taking on a life of its own and was becoming really something unmanageable for the Communist Party, for the Beijing leadership. And on top of that, you had workers from the countryside that had come to the city to find work and get money to send back. So they were joining protests in different factories on the outskirts of Beijing. So you had really an alarming situation and forced the Communist Party to declare martial law and bring some 300,000 soldiers to Beijing. So this was James Lilly, U.S. ambassador, and the former 30-year-long veteran of the CIA together with George Bush Sr. And Lilly was also, as George Bush Sr., a member of a bizarre secret society at Yale University called Skull and Bones, which ironically, was founded by the Russell family, one of the unknown oligarchic families of the American establishment, who made their fortune in the 1800s through opium trade with China, you know, flooding China with opium. So I don't want to divert from Tiananmen Square, but this was, in fact, a completely synthetic staged protest. And because there's so many students in China, it took on a life of its own.
1983 seems to be an extremely pivotal year that marks the establishment of three extremely important NGOs, the National Endowment for Democracy, George Soros' Open Society in Budapest, Hungary, and Gene Sharp's Albert Einstein Institute in Cambridge, Massachusetts, all founded while George H.W. Bush is Reagan's vice president and while William Casey is CIA head. Let's take a look at the Albert Einstein Institute. What did it have to do with Albert Einstein?
Nothing. And Gene Sharp said as much once in an interview. He just took the name to give it a little bit of scientific credibility. But the creation of these private NGOs, this privatization of the CIA to do regime change, was part of a very, and the reason I wrote the book is it's very, very poorly understood how sophisticated the U.S. intelligence created these so-called private NGOs, the National Endowment for Democracy, the International Republican Institute of the NED, and the various other spin-offs. The Soros Open Society Foundations that you mentioned were created the same time, and also the Gene Sharp Institute. And they refined this with social media. They had the RAND Corporation, a Pentagon think tank, developing techniques of so-called swarming, like swarms of bees. And they studied great military leaders from Genghis Khan to Alexander the Great to Napoleon. And their military tactics all involve some application of these swarming techniques that you can monitor with insects and birds and so forth. So they developed social media as this was later developed in the early part of the 21st century. They developed Twitter, Facebook, and so forth to refine this and coordinate this. So 1983 was a crucial year. It was the beginning of putting this in place. And to return again to Tiananmen Square, I don't know if you want to finish with that, but one thing I would like to add is there was never a student massacre at Tiananmen Square in June of 1989. There were never mass shootings of Chinese students. Jay Matthews, a prize-winning U.S. journalist who later worked with the Washington Post, was present in June at Tiananmen Square. And he said in an article for the Columbia Journalism Review years later, as far as can be determined from available evidence, no one died that night in Tiananmen Square. A few people were killed by random shooting in streets near the square. These were workers who got pretty angry and hotted up against the government for various reasons. But all eyewitness accounts say the students who remained in the square when troops arrived were allowed in the middle of the night to leave peacefully. So James Lilly didn't allow this to be reported to the Western media. He engineered fake news to claim that he went to hospitals and visited wounded students and estimated that there were 200 or 300 students that were shot by soldiers and all these things. So, of course, the international media picked that up and sanctions were applied against China and so forth, because the whole opening up that had been planned as part of this Tiananmen Square destabilization by the democracy NGOs of Washington, the Chinese government had clamped down on that. They did not allow it to go further the way that Yeltsin and company were allowed to do in the Soviet Union.
I'm speaking with scholar and author William Engdahl. Today's show, Fake Democracy. The CIA and their NGOs target China and Yugoslavia in the 1990s. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. You write that on June 3rd, events reached a climax. Western journalists and select student leaders began reporting to Western media that the Chinese People's Liberation Army had begun a massacre of students at Tiananmen. Then on June 4th, Tiananmen Square was peacefully cleared of student demonstrators. Deng Xiaoping wanted no deaths from the breaking up of the protests. So then would you say that the massacre of students in Tiananmen Square is a case of fake news about a fake massacre?
Yeah, as I said, it's one of the great fake news frauds that have been promoted by the U.S. government, U.S. intelligence. And James Lilly played the key role in spreading that. Voice of America, was involved, and that's a U.S. government propaganda agency. And they simply kept repeating this lie over and over and over again. But the students weren't machine gunned down by the military. They were, as you said, Deng Xiaoping said there cannot be student massacres. That will be disastrous. We cannot allow that. So they were, despite provocations, they were given orders not to shoot. And then they reached a deal in the middle of the night with the student leaders to peacefully allow the students to leave in the darkness of night, which is what happened. And I've talked with a number of Chinese in visits there who confirmed this, that this was what happened.
And what was Operation Yellowbird?
Well, this was James Lilly's operation to smuggle out the key. It's a CIA operation, underground network, to get the key student leaders who were being encouraged by the CIA and U.S. government. Maybe they thought in their heart of hearts that they were, bringing democracy to China, but they were actually doing the dirty work of the CIA, in fact. So Lilly and the U.S. embassy gave them sanctuary, the key student leaders, and then had this underground network to smuggle them into Hong Kong, which was then still British. And then the key leaders were flown to Paris, onto the U.S. Some of them were admitted to Harvard, some of them to Princeton. Some of them went to work for the Bain & Company consulting department. But they were given a comfortable time of it for their services to the U.S. Embassy.
With regard to Gene Sharp's book, From Dictatorship to Democracy, A Conceptual Framework for Liberation, you write that Gene Sharp was the architect of the CIA's strategy of nonviolence as a weapon of warfare. According to your book, Gene Sharp and his second in command were actually in Beijing during the mass student democracy protests. Isn't that right?
Yes. And they were in Tiananmen Square area 2 weeks before the protests, the hunger strike began. And hunger strike is one of the key tactics that Gene Sharp describes in his handbook. So, and Colonel Robert Helvey, a U.S. military veteran, who's the key trainer for Gene Sharp's Einstein Institute. And they were on the scene until the Chinese security police forced them to leave. The same, by the way, with Soros, the head of the Soros China Foundation for the opening of China, was arrested, called in, and forced to close down the, Soros was forced to close down his NGO, his China operation there at the time of the protests.
Right. So the Chinese Communist government put a stop to all of this, and they threw all these guys out of China, including Soros's fund for the reform and opening of China, Gene Sharp and his crew. What about the National Endowment for Democracy? Did they get them out of China, too?
I don't have any evidence that they forced them out of China, but maybe that was more difficult for them to crack or to figure out. I don't know. But in fact, they accused Soros's China Foundation of cooperating with the CIA. So that's an actual concrete instance where China, where Soros and the CIA are named.
Do you think that the term non-governmental organization, NGO, is really an oxymoron, seeing as how the most powerful NGOs are funded by the U.S. government?
Well, I would not make a blanket statement, but I would certainly say about certain human rights and democracy, quote-unquote, NGOs, that is an oxymoron. They're very much government front operations. But there's been a weaponization of human rights and the weaponization of democracy NGOs by the CIA, by U.S. intelligence, by the State Department over the past 35 years or so since the NED was created in the 80s, which you mentioned earlier, Bonnie. And this has proven to be for the U.S. Government and U.S. intelligence one of the most effective weapons to get rid of leaders and governments that don't sing to the music that Washington wants to hear. So it's a weaponization of human rights and democracy NGOs, I would describe it. Not all NGOs are fronts for the CIA or the government by a long shot, but those particular ones certainly are. And that's what I describe in the book.
You begin your chapter, Washington and Their NGOs Disintegrate Yugoslavia, with the subheading, The Threat of an Independent EU. Did the U.S. consider an independent Europe a threat? And if so, why?
This is one of the things that is very poorly understood. In the end of the 1980s, 1989, around the time that Tiananmen Square and the breakdown of the Soviet Union and the Yugoslav War was begun, the U.S. economy was in horrible shape. It was in an earlier real estate crisis meltdown, an oil crisis. Oil prices had collapsed, so Texas was, and oil states like Texas were in very bad economic shape, and the banking system. So at that point, Europe was beginning to create a new cohesion, a new strategy that people in Washington began to see as a potential threat. And they couldn't accept the idea of an independent Europe. So certain European leaders were talking about Europe independent of NATO, that with the Soviet Union gone, you know, collapsed in the early 90s, that there was no longer a need for U.S.-controlled NATO, and Europe was coming together with technology, with economy, with the gross domestic product, with Germany's economic power. So some people in Washington saw that Europe could begin asserting its own identity in a way after the end of the Cold War. So that wasn't greeted with joy, certainly not by George Bush and this intelligence community around him.
You note that 1989 was also the year the Berlin Wall came down. People thought the Cold War was over, and that the Soviet Union was no longer considered a threat, which you have just pointed out. Could you explain what the Maastricht Treaty was all about? It included a common European defense that was not NATO. Isn't that right?
Yes. The Maastricht Treaty was the treaty that created a single European currency with the European Central Bank. And it also called for a common European foreign policy and a common European defense pillar, as it was called. And that was something that was really not welcomed in Washington, to put it bluntly.
Now, you write in your book, Manifest Destiny, about a war in the heart of Europe. And of course, at this point in time, and George H.W. Bush is president, things have calmed down. People are expecting a peace dividend. Why was a war in the heart of Europe a desired strategy for U.S. hegemony?
Well, there are many reasons, but I think the Yugoslav, we're talking about Yugoslavia and the way that that was broken up over the course of the decade of the 90s. And there were a number of reasons. One of them was that Yugoslavia had a mixed economy. It was a communist country with a mixed socialist and state and private model. It wasn't pure top-down central planning like in Moscow. So that had a certain success that certain people in Washington did not want to see Russia and other former communist countries adopting the so-called Yugoslav model. I think the more fundamental point was to create a war in the heart of Europe was seen by certain people in Washington around Bush and later Clinton as a very good way to say, Europe can't handle it. We have to have NATO. And that's indeed what took place in the 90s.
Well, now you have pointed out the fact that the United States in and around 89-90 was in poor economic shape. What kind of economic shape was Yugoslavia in around the same time? We talked in our last show about the oil crisis of 73-74 and again in 1979 as being contrived and how that oil crisis led to Poland's debt. Is the same true of Yugoslavia?
Yugoslavia had to borrow dollars to get enough oil to run their economy. So shortly before the breakup of Yugoslavia in the end of the 80s, they had more than $20 billion in foreign debts. And that was so much that half of the country's hard currency earnings were for debt service on those borrowings. And keep in mind that a lot of that was borrowed in the 70s. But then when Paul Volcker came in 1979 through 82, the U.S. raised the interest rates on those dollar debts in the world economy by 300%. So countries like Yugoslavia were suddenly caught in a debt trap. So the country's economy was really vulnerable because of this foreign debt. And then the International Monetary Fund was brought in from Washington, the U.S.-controlled International Monetary Fund, was brought in to dictate how to deal with that debt. And that is what destroyed Yugoslavia's economy and created this breakup.
Yes, that seems to be the same history with all of these former communist or socialist countries. I'm speaking with scholar and author William Engdahl. Today's show, Fake Democracy. The CIA and their NGOs target China and Yugoslavia in the 1990s. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. The IMF made loans to Yugoslavia during the two global oil crises of the 70s, which you just mentioned.
Yeah.
The debt was then used to cripple the economy. The IMF prevented the Yugoslav government from obtaining credit from its own central bank. Therefore, it was unable to finance social and other programs. They dollarized the Yugoslav economy. You also write that the IMF ordered a wage freeze at 1989 levels while inflation skyrocketed, all of which you've pretty much gone over. You write that the 1991 U.S. Foreign Operations Appropriations Act was the match that lit the fuse for war in the Balkans under George H.W. Bush. What was this act?
Well, this was the Foreign Operation Appropriation Act of 1991, and it demanded, in order to get U.S. financial support, and at a time when they were, you described the economic conditions, the IMF was ordering privatization of state enterprises, and companies were going bankrupt under the price liberalization and wage freeze. And, you know, it's just a horrendous economic situation. And this new law by the U.S. Congress, which nobody talks about, demanded separate election in each of the six Yugoslav republics, Croatia, Slovenia, Bosnia-Herzegovina, Serbia, and so forth. And in effect, that Congressional Foreign Operation Appropriation Act forced the breakup of Yugoslavia. And they said only groups defined by the U.S. State Department as democratic forces would get U.S. money. So you had all of a sudden U.S. money going to tiny right-wing nationalist parties, and the whole Yugoslavia suddenly was warring in six different directions, each against the other, to get the, you know, the best conditions they could from this.
So the U.S. was able to affect the breakup of Yugoslavia into these separate states by withholding the money unless they conformed to certain conditions. Now,
yeah.
Right-wing and fascist organizations, not seen since the defeat of the Nazis, as you write about, had been covertly maintained in exile by the U.S., Britain, and NATO, and they were the ones receiving U.S. funds and arms, right?
Yes, yes. And some of them were pretty nasty. The memories of World War II, where you had in Croatia, the Ustashi, they ran concentration camps, which even the Nazis were shocked by. One of the most famous was Jasenovac. So when you had Croatian separatists beginning to hearken back to this World War II experience, you created complete panic in Serb and other parts of the population. The CIA really did some ugly things in Yugoslavia.
So Bush decided to bring in the Mujahideen terror war model into Yugoslavia after the collapse of the Warsaw Pact in 1991. You write about this. What did bringing the Afghan Mujahideen into minority Muslim Bosnia-Herzegovina entail?
Well, it entailed bringing Osama bin Laden personally into Bosnia-Herzegovina. Now, what a lot of people don't realize is that at the time the war began between Serbia, between Bosnia-Herzegovina, between Croatia and so forth, in the early 90s, Bosnia-Herzegovina was evenly divided, you know, one-third, 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 between ethnic Croats, between Muslim Bosniaks, and between Orthodox Christian Serbs. And, you know, you had intermarriages between Muslim Bosniaks and Catholic Croatians in Bosnia-Herzegovina. But the U.S. manipulated the situation such that the political control fell under someone that they had sponsored, Izetbegović, who was a Bosniak Muslim. And Izetbegović went back to World War II and the Nazi SS Hanchar division, a division of Bosnian Muslims that was set up during the war to fight for the Nazis against Serbs and Jews and Gypsies in Yugoslavia.
Well, then, what was the Lisbon Treaty of March 18th, 1992, between all three leaders of Bosnia-Herzegovina? Like you've talked about, you've mentioned the Catholic Croats, the Bosnian Muslims, and Orthodox Christian Serbs. Wasn't the presidency of Bosnia-Herzegovina was supposed to revolve, right?
Yes, it was supposed to rotate between those three ethnic groups.
Now, you've written that the United States ambassador to Yugoslavia, this guy Warren Zimmerman, asked this Itza Begovic to renege on this, right?
Yeah. Well, that's Begovic had signed the agreement along with the leadership of the Srpska is what it's called today, the Srpska Republic, and also with the Croatian. And Zimmerman flew in and convinced Itza Begovic to tear up the agreement and declare himself the president. In effect, that's what happened.
In your book, you write that Reuter Finn, a Washington PR firm, worked on behalf of Itza Begovic.
Yes.
And that Serbia and Serbs were demonized and called Nazis. How is calling Serbs Nazis the height of irony?
Well, this Reuter Finn PR operation that Itza Begovic was linked up with, and I think that was a very carefully done operation from the State Department, they boasted about the fact that nobody in the United States knew what was going on in Yugoslavia. They were completely baffled, if they were interested at all. And as the head of Reuter Finn said, most Americans probably thought Yugoslavia was some African country or Bosnia. So then they decided to go after the support of U.S. Jewish organizations to turn them against the Serbs. Now, that wasn't so easy for Jewish organizations that knew anything about the true history of World War II, because the Croatian fascist Ustashi during World War II and the Bosnian Muslim Waffen-SS Hanjar Division carried out atrocities against Jews during the Second World War, and not Serbs. The Serbs were not doing such things. So they seized on an article in Reuter Finn, the PR firm of Itza Begovic. They seized on an article in New York Newsday newspaper about detention camps that Serbs had for prisoners who were fighting against the Serbs. And the New York Newsday called them concentration camps. So, of course, those words are electric for Jewish organizations, and most people associate concentration camps with the Nazis, Auschwitz, and so forth. So they use that to win the alliance of the Jewish organizations across America, and the press picked up on that and started talking about Serbs carrying out ethnic cleansing, concentration camps, and the images of Auschwitz, and so forth. So it was an emotional change, and that began the demonization of the Serbs. Really a tragic and a horribly one-sided demonization that took place.
You point out that the Srebrenica region in Bosnia was a safe haven for Muslim fighters who savagely slaughtered Serbian Christians in Srpska, the Serb part of Bosnia. Who was Nasser Oric?
Nasser Oric was the military leader in charge of the Bosnian Muslim forces in Srebrenica. And most people today associate Srebrenica with a Serb massacre of innocent Muslim civilians in that enclave, safe haven, UN safe haven. But in fact, Nasser Oric was really one of the unindicted or unconvicted war criminals of the whole Yugoslav civil war, is what it began as. He would launch attacks. He would use the UN secure status of Srebrenica and then from there have hit-and-run attacks during Christian Orthodox holidays of the Serbs, and would destroy entire villages, massacre all inhabitants, men, women, and child, and create such a hatred, between Bosniaks and Serbs that it was unbelievable. So he was a warlord, a terrorist, and one of the most horrific. He wouldn't take prisoners. He said, one can't be bothered with prisoners, kill them. So he was one of the leading military people under Izetbegovic, Bosniaks.
Well, now, Oric led the Mujahideen, and in your book, I was amazed to see how many countries in the Middle East were sending in fighters to fight the war. I never realized that it was so many fighters that went in there. And of course, in your book, you point out somebody actually saw Osama bin Laden several times in Izetbegovic's office right there in Sarajevo. Well, what was the Srebrenica massacre, and what was the role of U.S. media giants, the New York Times, CNN, and other media, with regard to this massacre?
This is, I would say, one of the most sensitive and one of the most emotional events of that tragic 10-year-long war in Yugoslavia. Oric, as I said earlier, was leading these savage attacks on small Serb villages around Srebrenica and creating this enormous revenge attitude among the Serb population against Oric and the the Bosnian terrorists that he commanded. So the Serbs were about to go after Oric in Srebrenica, but he had secretly pulled his jihad troops out of Srebrenica several days before it fell. And Bosnian Serb Army Commander Mladic, who was recently, to my mind, unjustly condemned by the Hague, was led into an ambush, a trap in Srebrenica. He expected to find resistance, to find Oric's savage troops there, and there was no resistance. And suddenly, his soldiers just went berserk, and the general Philippe Morillon, a French, described this and what Oric has done. And he said, I don't believe that Mladic ordered the massacre. It was my personal opinion. But the Serbs, his troops just went crazy and started not killing women and children, but shooting the men that they could find in and around Srebrenica. And Nazar Oric, probably with help from the CIA, set up this trap to demonize the Serbs. And that was very effectively done by NATO propaganda.
I'm speaking with scholar and author William Engdahl. Today's show, Fake Democracy. The CIA and their NGOs target China and Yugoslavia in the 1990s. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. What was Operation Deliberate Force?
Operation Deliberate Force, NATO announced this operation to have airstrikes against Bosnian Serb positions. Now, these are ethnic Serbs living in what today is called Republika Srpska, one of the autonomous, under the Dayton Agreements, one of the autonomous parts of Bosnia and Herzegovina. So they started NATO airstrikes against these Bosnian positions. And artillery attacks from UNPROFOR, the UN forces there. So, NATO just started bombing Serbia. And this gave the Clinton administration the excuse that they were looking for to continue also the argument for the continuation of NATO.
And then why did the U.S. abruptly end the Bosnian War?
Well, they had the Dayton Agreements in Paris in 1995 because I think the U.S. intelligence had their eye on moving toward Serbian Yugoslavia in the province of Kosovo on the border with Albania to focus on that as a key base. In fact, they established Camp Bon Steel in Kosovo after the after the bombing of Serbia, of Belgrade in 1999.
You write that the U.S. military contractor, Military Professional Resources Incorporated, trained both the drug-running Albanian KLA and the Croatian army to ethnically cleanse 350,000 Serbs out of the Krajina region of Croatia. What role did U.S. Ambassador to Croatia, Peter Galbraith, play in this ethnic cleansing?
Well, Galbraith completely downplayed the fact that this was going on. His mandate was to portray the Croatians as the good guys and cover up the ethnic cleansing that was going on there. So he played a very not nice role.
What can you tell us about the 79-day bombing of Belgrade and the precision bombing of the Chinese embassy offices of the Chinese military attaché? This, you write about, was Clinton's, he called it Operation Noble Anvil.
Yeah, they come up with these names, don't they? The Clinton administration claimed, first of all, they created something called the Kosovo Liberation Army, as you pointed out. And they created the Kosovo Liberation Army out of essentially the Kosovo drug mafia families, the clans. And these were mafia networks that the CIA began arming and pointing the guns at the Serbs. Kosovo was an integral part of Yugoslavia, but of Serbian Yugoslavia. And many ethnic Serbs were living in Kosovo along with ethnic Albanians. And I think one of the reasons that the CIA wanted to have this enclave in Kosovo was that the heroin that was being smuggled into the West from Afghanistan, which the U.S. had just managed to get involved with the Mujahideen in the 1980s, the heroin came and was transmitted into Western Europe through the Kosovo Mafia that became the Kosovo Liberation Army. So it's really a dirty, dirty story.
Well, now, Kosovo was always a part of Serbia. How was it that Bill Clinton was able to get away with a 79-day NATO bombing of Serbia? Now, that's illegal, right, for NATO to do any such thing, as well as bomb Bosnia. That's against the NATO charter, isn't it?
Yes, yes. But that didn't seem to bother Bill Clinton. What Clinton did was to manipulate the government of Germany under Gerhard Schroeder, but mainly the foreign minister, Joschka Fischer, who was the head of the Green Party. Nominally, the Green Party was a pacifist anti-war party in its origins, but Joschka Fischer made a deal with Bill Clinton. And it's interesting, after he retired from government, Joschka Fischer was given a visiting professor position at Princeton University. But they claimed that the Serbs were doing ethnic cleansing of Kosovo Albanians, and that for humanitarian reasons, with the backing of Germany, so that the U.S. wouldn't be completely alone, that the Clinton administration had to bomb Belgrade into submission. And the bombing, by the way, I was given a tour of Belgrade about 5 years ago, and they showed me the national police headquarters of what was Yugoslavia, and the U.S. bombed that headquarters with all the security records and everything with depleted uranium weapons. And they didn't announce that, so that after the bombing stopped, when Serb authorities went in to try to recover the records, they were poisoned immediately by the radiation from these depleted uranium weapons inside the building and just dropped in. So this was really an ugly campaign. You mentioned the bombing of the Chinese embassy, and that was not a mistake of an old map that the Defense Mapping Agency had given to the Pentagon. This was deliberate because the Chinese were supporting Yugoslavia. They were supporting Serbia, Milosevic, as were the Russians, by the way.
Milosevic, the president of Yugoslavia, was really the last holdout against the breakup of Yugoslavia. Now, the U.S. was determined to get rid of Milosevic. Even with this bombing, they were unable to unseat him. Then you go on to write about the Belgrade coup d'etat of 2000. You write about the student-based opposition NGO, Washington trained and brought into being with the Serb name Otpor, or Resistance, and that it was this operation that finally took down Milosevic. How did this work?
Otpor became the template that was used by the U.S. government and their fake democracy. The U.S. government and its NGOs created a organization in Belgrade called Otpor, that means resistance, and the NED, through the International Republican Institute, paid for several dozen leaders of Otpor to come to the Hilton Hotel in Budapest in Hungary and attend training seminars there. So these were hand-picked leaders. They still work with the U.S. intelligence to this very day, and in fact train students or student leaders in color revolutions all around the world. They made, you know, quite a profitable little business out of this. But this was one of the first applications of these techniques that had been devised by the RAND Corporation, by the CIA and the State Department for getting rid of governments that they don't like. So Otpor had as its logo the famous silhouette of a clenched fist. Everything that they did was given by Washington PR consultants for maximum effect. And all of their tactics, the hit-and-run protest demonstrations where the police would always come and find that the demonstrators had left, that was all coordinated by global satellite communication and so forth. Before the days of Facebook. Later, they used Facebook for this. So Otpor was the key U.S. Vehicle for the Belgrade coup d'etat of 2000 and was the first of these so-called color revolutions that toppled an elected government. And student leaders from Otpor had special intelligence helmets that were given to them by the U.S. with video screens, so they had an overview of the whole field. And, they had constant cell phone dialogue. The security forces of Milosevic were just overwhelmed. They'd never come into anything like this. So it made the authority appear to be impotent. And that's what the whole Gene Sharp strategy was aimed at.
I believe you write in your book that there was an election and somehow Milosevic lost this election and then was forced to resign by the Serbian military. Is that right?
Yes, the military was essentially blackmailed after this horrendous bombing and so forth. So in 2001, they arrested Milosevic, not charging him with any crime officially, but it was U.S. pressure to extradite him to the International Criminal Tribunal in The Hague. That was set up especially for Yugoslavia, former Yugoslavia, on charges of war crimes, crimes against humanity. And, you know, at that point, Milosevic had no recourse when his own army turned on him.
Well, now, Milosevic spent, 5 years incarcerated at The Hague and then was found dead under suspicious circumstances, right?
Yeah, but it eliminated an embarrassing witness to the real NATO role in the breakup of Yugoslavia, because Milosevic knew exactly the perfidy and deception and lies and criminal acts that were done to destroy Yugoslavia.
And finally, what do we know about Camp Bondsteel in Kosovo? How important is this U.S. base?
Well, it's the second largest base, U.S. base in Europe, and it was established after the kicking out of Milosevic and the splitting off of Kosovo by the United States. It's, Kosovo is not recognized as an independent country by many other countries, but the U.S. has recognized it. And the Camp Bondsteel gives the U.S. a crucial base of something like 7,000 soldiers and support people to not only control Serbia, but a control point for the entire area of the Russian Black Sea Fleet in the Black Sea, in what is now Russian Crimea, and the strategic reserves of oil in the Caspian Sea. So this gave the U.S. a very critical military positioning in the heart of Europe, and also gave a strong argument that the U.S. used to say Europe can't manage on its own. We and NATO have to take care of the security of Europe. So NATO continued.
William Engdahl, thank you so much.
Thank you, Bonnie, and I enjoyed very much being on your program again.